Hello and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb Keith, and today I am joined by Bruce Hillman. Say hello, Bruce.
Hello.
And Adam Francisco. Say hello.
Sup.
Sup. Yeah. What's up, homie? West Coast, Best Coast. The Thinking Fellows is brought to you by the 1517 Podcast Network. You can go to 1517.org/podcasts to see all of our shows there. And we do love all of our listeners who are not on the West Coast. Bruce is our East Coast representation, and Adam's in Chicago. So we have the whole country except the South covered today. So that's not too bad. Although this might be an episode kind of targeted at the South, I think, at least the way I see this, because it depends on the type of denomination where you hear this objection. But today's episode topic is, are Roman Catholics Christians? Now, I've been hearing this question come up a lot. It comes up on Twitter relatively frequently. I heard somebody bring this up in person, and I know two people who call themselves converts to Christianity who grew up Roman Catholic. It's a very interesting one. I will say I usually hear this. The reason I said the South is I usually hear this from people who are more Baptist in their leanings than I do from, say, the more historical Protestant churches. I don't hear this from lifelong Lutherans frequently and things like that. But I recently, and by recently, I mean in the last 6 months, had a visitor at our church in Big Bear who I was talking to after the service, who told me that the first 20 minutes of our service was very uncomfortable for her because it reminded her too much of Roman Catholicism and not of Christian worship, which I thought was very interesting. And so I thought we could kind of tackle this.
I always think it's weird when someone visits a church and then like gives you a criticism right away. I'm always like, there's the door. Have a nice day.
Bruce's church famous for growing very quickly. I'm just kidding, Bruce. I guess the reason to answer this question is I think we would all just sort of give a yes off the bat. So there's probably more to unpack here than just saying yes. I think a big part of this is, why does this question come up? What is the distinction between Protestants and Catholics if it isn't this big C Christianity? Isn't the distinction, and so on and so forth. I think it also blends into some other questions that maybe we'll have time to talk about as well. Like, I'll say online, there's a huge wave of Lutherans denying that Lutherans are Protestants all the time. They do this weird semantics thing that we're not Protestants. Or the other one I'll see is that Lutherans aren't evangelicals either, which is funny either way you slice it. Historically, that was what we were. And then especially for conservative Lutherans like the Missouri Synod, is politically identified in its like organizational leanings as a evangelical church in America versus a mainline church. So even in those kinds of splits, has those. So Christians are always kind of, or maybe Lutherans especially, are always kind of playing these word games with what are we in the grand scheme of things, and the what are we in compared to other Christians. But for this episode, we'll start with a focus on, are Roman Catholics Christian? Now, Bruce, I think you've told us on the show before that you grew up Catholic, and then you've had sort of a journey to what was a more sort of Pentecostal type of Christianity and then to Lutheranism. So maybe you've gone full circle on this. Maybe you can put some perspective into it.
Yeah, I grew up in a French Catholic family, very
there's the postmodern thing. French.
I was about to say this.
Very mind-interesting.
My mother's maiden name is DuPont, and faith was very important on her side of the family. And very strict Roman Catholic, but strict not meaning like harsh or mean, just we observed all the feast days and did all the things that you're supposed to do. And church was really very, very important to us growing up. And we did, you know, CCD and all the Catholic things. So I never had any objection to Catholicism until I ended up going to a Protestant Christian school in high school and got exposed to Protestantism. But that school was hosted by an Assemblies of God church, even though the school itself was not denominational. And I was just seeing all this stuff that was confusing me. And I remember calling the priest one day and asking him specifically why the Catholics had extra books in their Bible that my Protestant friends didn't have. And I had my confirmation Bible, it was confirmed in the Catholic Church, so I knew it had extra books because I had it in front of me. And to make a long story short, the priest said, stop asking these kinds of questions. When you go to a Catholic Mass and you look into the pew in front of you, he goes, do you see any Bibles? I said, no. He says, what do you see? I said, missals. He goes, yeah, and why is that? I said, I don't know. He goes, because you're not supposed to read the Bible. He goes, the church reads it for you and tells you what it means. You're not qualified. You're a layman. You will make mistakes. You will not interpret this correctly from your own life experience. You'll be in danger if you read this on your own. You can read it on your own, he said, but you shouldn't read it on your own and deduce theological things from it, truths from it. That the magisterium does that. And then I had a question about the cult of Mary and the infallibility of the Pope. So those are my three questions. And we never got to the other two.
Because how old were you when you were asking these questions? I imagine you were like 12.
17, no, I was like 16.
Okay. He's one of those kids.
So I stayed in the Catholic Church for another 4 years, but I was kind of attending the Protestant Church at the same time. And then I couldn't reconcile those three beliefs particularly. Those were very important to me. And so I just went to the Assemblies of God Church because that was like the only other context I had. But they were not a like super charismatic Assemblies of God Church. They were great people. But I just couldn't get used to that style of worship coming out of Catholicism. It just felt like blasphemous to me, even though I knew I knew factually it wasn't. It was just another expression. But I just coming out of like genuflecting and being like, I just couldn't do like the clap your hands and raise your hand. Couldn't do it.
Too foreign.
So that started me on a journey. I attended the Anglican Church for a while, but that I just felt like Catholicism again without a pope to me. So I wasn't ready for that. Went to a Baptist church for about a year, and their youth group couldn't get behind the Baptist theology. And then a friend of mine invited me to a Lutheran church, and that's how I ended up in Lutheranism. So that's kind of my story. I still appreciate very much my Catholic upbringing and still really love a lot of parts about that, even though there are things that I currently would, object to.
Was part of that journey, so you brought up three big questions, ones that are sort of reformational questions, right? The infallibility of the Pope, the cult of Mary, certainly, and you can just sort of maybe even, praying to the saints, various intercession of the saints, stuff like that. And then sola scriptura, right, really comes forth. At any point in that journey, did that question come up? Are these, maybe even after an answer of sort of telling you not to read the Bible, are these people even Christian? Is this even a Christian church that doesn't believe the Bible? Does any of that give you any insight to why people, do you think, come to that conclusion or certain churches teach that Roman Catholics are not Christians?
This is anecdotal as my own opinion, and it's part of it comes, of course, from my experience. But I think a lot of times when people who grew up Catholic, air quotes, convert to Protestantism or some other faith tradition, and they usually end up having kind of a bad taste of Catholicism left in their mouth because they converted. So that's, they moved, they transferred to a different tradition. I found that a lot of times, though, there's hurt there. There's hurt somewhere there. And it's not often about just, oh, this is a different theological idea that I couldn't reconcile, and so I left for purely intellectual reasons. Most people don't leave for purely intellectual reasons. They come to learn something new, and then they sort of like feel betrayed or upset, and there's some other context going on. Like, I wanted that to be my story when I was a teenager. I wanted to have a good reason to leave the church because they had done something mad. And I also wanted a reason not to become a Protestant. So I remember when I would go to the Christian school, I would bring my Mary statues, my little Mary statues, and put them on my desk. And I was waiting for someone to tell me, you can't have that. And because I knew it, once they told me I can't have that, I could say, well, what do you mean? And no one ever did. And that was a big deal to me because I was like, oh my gosh, like I know this is ticking them off. I'm like, that's why I'm doing it. They never told me to take it down. They never, you know, pointed it out and said, like, they knew I was a Catholic. So they didn't give me an excuse. And, like, even though the priest was kind of dismissive, he was just answering questions the way, based on, you know, what they taught. So I couldn't be mad at him. Like, he wasn't hurting me or doing anything to, I was disappointed he didn't want to engage more, but he probably just, that's just like, he gave me my answer. So I think that a lot of times when people feel that another tradition from their own, especially when they came out of, is not good anymore, there's usually some sense of betrayal or being taken advantage of or being hurt or being strong-armed or something there, usually, that people don't want to address. So they so then they tell people why they converted. They always give them the theological reasons. And those are important, but usually there's more going on, in my experience.
Adam, do the Reformation reasons, say sola scriptura, some of these other historic reasons, are they enough to, so they were obviously enough to justify eventual separation from the church upon, let's say, Worms and the rejection of the Augsburg Confession, were enough to say, okay, we are not the same church. We have our own confession, which includes the historic things like the creeds and stuff. Is that also enough to then sort of outright dismiss that the true or saving faith is then present to those who have not joined, say, to the confession, the Augsburg Confession, or other Protestant traditions, and stayed Catholic?
Can you rephrase that question?
I mean, are these reasons that are good justifications for a Reformation being necessary and Lutheranism existing strong enough to then say that's not Christianity over there?
So I would say to the first question, you know, sola scriptura, the solas, the five solas, is there enough theological warrant for the church to divide over those issues? Absolutely. And in fact, in the medieval Catholic tradition, there was all sorts of effort to move, not necessarily in that direction, but there were attempts throughout the Middle Ages to reform the church because they recognized that institutionally, organizationally, doctrinally, there were issues. It's 16th century, printing press, and a whole bunch of other factors, I think, that play into the 16th century Reformation being successful and as large or prolific as it was. Does that then mean that Catholics aren't Christians? Is that the
second question? Are those reasons then so significant
they disqualify
that
you?
They disqualify people who reject them from?
So it's, I mean, now that we're asking the question of the 21st century, right? Which, and I know when it comes to doctrine, time and space doesn't matter, or if it's real dogma, right? But
well, I think one could argue that the church has, in an odd sort of turn of phrase, that, like you said, the medieval church was maybe also, there were groups, individuals, who were recognizing some of these errors as well. But then as the Reformation happens, the church kind of confirms those errors then in a weird twist of fate, right? With Trent and the Counter-Reformation.
Yeah.
And has continued to do so, like with Vatican II. So, so the question is, I guess, even if this is an old question, pretty recently the church as a formal organization, the Catholic Church, has confirmed some of these errors. Does that justify people, you know, putting into question that people in that church have saving faith?
I think it maybe would justify asking the question about proper Roman Catholic theology. But I mean, the question you ask at the beginning, I think, is an interesting question. I've certainly heard it before. And back in the days when I was an undergrad and thought I maybe didn't know everything yet, I certainly could know everything about everything, would have had taken a much harder line against Roman Catholicism. But the thing is, like, even in the case of Luther's life, I think it was 1543, it's right before he dies, a couple of years before he dies, he writes this work called On the Papacy of Rome, subtitled An Institution of the Devil. Mm-hmm. But he also can, in the same year, or within the same year, talk about how the Catholic Church has preserved pure some pure Christian doctrines over the course of the centuries. So the question is an interesting question, but it's a really hard question to answer, because church membership does not make one a Christian. Now, it might tell you something about what the individual who attends or has held membership in a church believes, but not always. People are weird. I mean, look at Bruce. He's got the Union Jack flying over his right shoulder.
People are weird. This was a kind of a weird revelation to me, right? As somebody who's, I don't know, been a member in the same church body from birth to current, right? That, and maybe this is, that like confessional Lutherans take church membership even to this day, not all of them, but some of us take church membership more seriously than a lot of Christians. And I was visiting some church where, you know, I had like four conversations with different members who all believed really different things about, say, like the Trinity, for instance, was a very interesting one. And what I realized was, is there was like, people will be members of churches that don't necessarily confess the exact same things as their personal beliefs, pretty commonly, I suppose.
Yeah. Let me tell you a little story, since Bruce got to tell a story, which makes sense since he's a postmodernist. They love to tell stories.
Stories are powerful.
Back in, I don't know, it was like 2004-ish, I was the teaching assist TA for this New Testament and Apostolic Fathers conference in Oxford. It was like the second time they held the conference. The one they had prior was in 1904 or 1905, you know, 100 years prior, right? So all these muckety-mucks from all over the world come in for this conference to give papers. People like big names, like Bart Ehrman, members of the Jesus Seminar, and so on and so forth. Anyway, I was the one who collected all the papers, did, you know, get this, Caleb, posted them to the internet.
Ooh.
And put a password, protected them so everybody could read the papers before the conference. Basically, it just meant I went to the computer center at Oxford and said, hey, can you help me do this? And I watched them do it. I mean, but, anyway, so everybody's checking in. There's this opening reception and dinner and so on. And this guy cozies up to me, who was on the faculty at Oxford that I had only heard of by name. His name was Tom Wynandy, Father or Dr. Tom Wynandy. He was what was he? He's, you know, he had taken some sort of monastic vows. He was part of the Grey Friars College or house or something, whatever that makes him, Capuchin or something like that. But he says, hey, I heard your Missouri Synod. And I said, yeah, how'd you hear that? And I knew he was Catholic. He had a reputation of being like an outstanding teacher and so on. He goes, believe it or not, you and I are the only two Orthodox Christians here. And I thought, well, that's weird. Now I lost, and I didn't have any, he probably would not remember that, though I have thought about maybe reaching out to him with an email, because I heard recently he left Oxford back some time ago to be like the Pope's representative in the United States or something under Ratzinger/Benedict, is it the 16th? Mm-hmm. I think Bruce would know, but has since resigned from whatever membership he has in some pontifical kind of group, because he is at odds with the current Pope. You read Tom Wynandy's literature or just his CV, and you cannot come away from it being like not just impressed, but blown away at how deep and broad his learning is. But more importantly, you read the literature, how profoundly Orthodox in terms of official cardinal Christian doctrines he maintains. So, like asking the question, are Catholics Christian? It's a very complicated question that a Baptist in the South who's never read Catholic theology can answer. I shouldn't have said it that way. That sounds kind of mean, I guess. But I think we should be very careful on how we answer the question, because there's a lot of nuance and complications. But the official...
Well, I'd even say you could spread the love. You could say, you know, like non-denominational or Saddleback evangelical, sure, in California who has never really engaged with it. Maybe sure. Maybe converted, whatever.
I don't know if the word is fortunate, but just because we're part of the Lutheran tradition, we have this sort of institutional memory and history, mm-hmm, and a lot of you know, just a lot of back and forth or controversy, conflict, and even sometimes some cooperation with Catholics in the, you know, in the 500-year tradition of the Lutheran confession. Catholics, like proper Catholics, will confess the Nicene Creed. Mm-hmm. They will not deny the physical or bodily resurrection of Jesus. In my view, that gets you in what Lewis would call mere Christianity. Where things get problematic, though, is like you suggested earlier, Caleb, they at Vatican, I'm not Vatican, the Council of Trent, sort of like the tail end of Luther's life, the 1540s and 1550s, the Catholic tradition or the Rome Church of Rome takes a particular stance on doctrine, whereas before there was a lot more diversity, and it was tolerated,
right?
At least
Lutheranism, and I would guess, you know, the political effects of Lutheranism caused them to have to, you know, like actually take a formal position, and so in some ways we forced the hand, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and in those formal positions, not on secondary doctrines, but what we would regard as cardinal doctrines, doctrine of justification,
for instance,
at
yeah.
the very center, they take a formal position in opposition to justification by grace through faith on account of Christ alone. And that's, I think, the real rub. At least it's the real rub for us. Because we know they believe in the Trinity, the two natures of Christ, and so on. But it's those things that make things complicated. But then you go to a Catholic church or you talk to a Catholic theologian, and they might articulate beautifully the doctrine of justification by grace through faith on account of Christ alone. They might use, they'll probably use different language, or sometimes they will articulate it similarly to, say, like a Lutheran position, but they'll mean something different by words like grace and so on. So all that to say,
one way to think about that for people who aren't well steeped in Catholic theology, the unique thing about Protestants, as say distinct from, like broadly speaking, is distinct from say the Orthodox or the Coptic or the Christians. By the way, the Coptics are always left out of the conversation, but they're Christians too. But they have some unique views on things. Generally speaking, the unique thing about Protestantism is that it sees justification as already completed, and the other major branches of Christianity do not. They see it as a process that's still unfolding in one's life, and that requires works in that process. Now Orthodox and Catholic and Coptic have slightly different nuanced ways to talk about how that relationship ends up affecting one's salvation. You know, in Catholicism, you have mortal sins, which are sins that lead to spiritual death. They take your salvation away, and so you have to go get intercession from a priest to have that grace restored, but you're still saved by grace. The grace has to be restored by the priest, but it's still, that's why they published, John Paul II published that, I don't know if it was an encyclical or just a statement, made a lot of waves in the 70s, early 80s, the Joint Declaration on Justification.
Right.
And, you know, some people, Protestants, criticize that as being kind of cosmetic and not really saying anything, but I think the hope of that was to sort of say, but at the end of the day, we do believe salvation's by grace. But where the confusion happens is the Catholics believe they're in a process where they can lose that grace, and Protestants tend to think that it's already completed and secured. And so I don't know if that's a distinction. While it's a very important distinction, and where you could even say one is right and one is wrong, I don't know that it's a salvation-killing distinction, because ultimately the agreement is salvation by grace and not by works alone. No one says that.
Right. I think, you know, I have been a very vocal anti-papist in person to people.
Anti-Catholic or anti-papist, though? Because those
I call Catholics papists, Bruce. I use the derogatory term. In fact, I don't even, it was several years ago that I forget what the exact tweet was, but I just straight up started calling people papists, and it was pretty funny. Probably not any helpful, but
very winsome.
Very winsome. But
but not untrue either.
So. Not untrue either. That's right. But what I've found that I think is funny is, right, if we just say what's the minimal,
which is always bad with the faith. I think this is some people's point about doing this is like, should you really be shooting for the minimal orthodox requirements for Christianity? No, you shouldn't be shooting for them before somebody sends an angry email. But they exist.
But the minimum, just to make a point here, but the minimum is important for the question of assurance, and that's why it needs to be asked. People at the end of the day want to know, well, how do I know that I'm? We have to find the line.
Yeah, and Catholics certainly qualify, as Adam said. You know, they confess the creeds, and I actually think the hope for all of us requires that we confess against ourselves and our own sin and our own will that is bound to sin. And that's part of the benefit of things like confessions and the church and sacraments and things like that, is that we are forced to confess against ourselves, and that there are whole churches which I have the hope and the faith that confess against themselves even when they're in error on a particular issue, and that Christ overcomes that. Because, you know, he is more powerful than human sin and has died and risen for that. What I think is funny, though, is that the error that you bring up that's the hardest on justification has to do with the cooperation with God to sort of justify. As Bruce said, it's not a complete work yet, and I'm working with God to complete. The Protestants who perhaps most frequently take up the position or an uncomfortable relationship with Catholics might say they're not Christian or be very wary about calling them Christians, have often done the same thing, but just by calling it sanctification, and tend to muddy the waters of justification anyways with a progressive holiness that is working with God to complete something that has to do with salvation and new life and the like. It just gets another word. When you talk to those people, like if you talk to a Catholic who's having assurance problems, and you talk to a Protestant or a non-denominational evangelical who's having assurance problems, both times it will usually be around, are they doing enough? Are they maintaining that relationship with God? They'll use some of the same words even. The relationship language is often, I find, shared between Catholics and non-denominationals and things like that. So it's kind of interesting to me that those two lob shots at each other a lot. And some of it seems that, despite the doctrines, maybe the errors being similar, it has to do with the worship being so different. Oftentimes, like Bruce said, people can bring up doctrinal reasons, but at the end of the day, there's sometimes personal hurt there, a pain of being forced to go to church as a child, maybe reactionary stuff. We're seeing sort of a revival of traditional Catholicism today where Protestants or not people who were raised in contemporary churches are converting to Catholicism for something more historic and real. And you see the other as well, you know, maybe somebody trying to take off the ancient and look for something more authentic to their experience. And so sometimes this just has to do with like the look, the feel, and things like that, which then gets Lutherans very often trapped in the middle. I've had Lutheranism described to me by a non-Lutheran when I said I was one as, oh, you guys are basically Catholics, right? Him referring to the fact that we have a liturgy and things like that. So I think there's definitely something interesting here, especially in America, where it can boil down to the reason somebody would say this is not because they've examined, is this a creedal faith? Is this something that believes in the Trinity, believes in Christ as Lord, etc.? But is this a foreign experience to what I think Christianity should be as an experience.
The theologian Philip Carey has a great article free online, if anyone wants to search for it, called Why Luther is Not Quite Protestant. And it's not very long. It's a great little article where he argues essentially that Lutherans, while in one sense clearly are in the Protestant camp, in another sense, if they are in the Protestant camp, they're on the line. And particularly because of their view of sacraments, which just puts them completely outside of what any other Protestants believe and moves them closer to Catholicism. But then they have like all these other Protestant views, what we later call Protestant views. So if anyone's interested in that, it's a really good read on just trying to figure out the placement of Lutheranism on the spectrum.
Yeah, and I guess what I've been thinking about, Caleb, is like what's this whole time is, what's the question behind the question? I know that's kind of a cliche kind of response, but like, why would one ask the question, are Catholics, or is the Catholic Church Christian, or however you want to phrase it?
I think there's probably two concerns, right? I think there's the one Bruce brought up very early, which is when people convert, sometimes they need the most justified reason to convert. And I think the most justifiable reason would be that isn't the true faith, right? You could come up with all the other doctrinal reasons or the hurt, but if you want the most powerful reason, it would be, I was not a Christian. That was not Christianity. And so then you have a very strong justification. I also think the opposite could be true. Somebody could be asking this question because they have friends or family, coworkers, you know, people they care about who are Roman Catholic. They're a Protestant or American evangelical Christian, and they've been taught or implied that those people are not Christian. And so now they have a concern and maybe some legitimate questions about what do Catholics believe and does it qualify them as Christians?
I say something here too, which I think is true of all denominations, but I think because the Catholic Church is so big that it maybe feels like it applies more to Catholics than Protestants. Just it feels that way, I think, which is there's always a difference in any denomination between the sort of high professional doctrinal theology and the way that that theology is believed and lived out on the lay kind of common level. So if you go to Catholic theology, it's, we don't worship statues. We do not worship Mary. I mean, this is very clear. This is spelled out explicitly. We do not worship Mary. We venerate her. We do not worship statues. You know, but if you talk to regular Catholics who don't have that theology, they might say, well, we do worship Mary, or we do pray to the saints. And we pray to the saints as intercessors. And their idea of what that means compared to what the high theology says intercessory prayers to the saints means usually is very different. And so Protestants who converse with uninformed Catholics will take away a view of Catholicism that is not true. And it's not really the church's fault that people in the church don't understand their own theology. It's not like the church isn't out trying to teach it all the time. It's just, it's so big. It's made up of so many cultural, subcultural groups in Catholicism. It's very connected to the expression of Catholicism is very connected to the cultural expression of where it lives, which is, I think, also different from a lot of Protestantism. Protestantism tends to be very kind of European or American, and wherever it goes, it maintains a little bit of that sort of westernized sense. But Catholicism adapts itself very well to the cultural expression of the area. That difference needs to be said, that there's this dichotomy between the high teachings of Catholicism and what actual Catholics might falsely believe about their theology.
Yeah, I think you're right. It does not help, though, with some Catholic messaging, though. I grew up in St. Louis, and I remember down the road, a little ways from our house, was a church, a Catholic church called Mary, Queen of the Universe.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're like, yow.
Well, and I think it matters which, kind of like you said, Bruce, which cultural expressions you're near. So like in California, right, there's a lot of Hispanic Catholics up here. Their veneration of Mary is like sort of extreme in Southern California Hispanic Catholicism. And so if you're a Protestant here, you could very easily get the impression that that's worship. Now, distinguishing prayer and worship and what praying to Mary or venerating Mary achieves and stuff like that is kind of nuanced. And one might be able to argue that the church says it's not worship and then functionally it is worship, whatever. You know, there's debates to be had there, but I think you're right. I think what you're near kind of tends to affect that. But I would say, you know, if we're taking Adam's question behind the question thing for a second, if you have had this question because you're concerned about a family member or a friend or somebody you care about who's Catholic, I think the answer is yes, you could probably confidently say they're Christian. They have the creed, they have
Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior. And even if they're in some error about that, he can and does overcome sin and intellectual error and things like that. But at the same time, there may be reasons then to still try to appeal to that person. I don't like calling it apologetics when it's inter-Christian. I don't know if, Adam, if you have an opinion on that. Like, I don't, but that
person, the same as yours.
Okay, yeah. That you could say that there are parts of the Roman Catholic faith that will attack or assault or not assist somebody's faith in moments of doubt or sin in this world, and that your faith, if it's Lutheranism, let's just say in our sake it's Lutheranism, has something to offer, has freedom, confidence, and in salvation to offer to that person. And so you should offer it because, you know, bringing them to the right beliefs on particular things, especially justification, is helpful and good and would be a gift of God to that person if they were able to have and cling to the confidence of justification that the scripture teaches and I think the church ought to teach.
I think part of the way it's trying to answer Adam's question, but from the other side, is part of the question behind the question is if you're a Catholic, it's tied up with your ethnicity a lot of times, your Catholicism, which is often true in...
Right, like you said, you grew up French Catholic, you know.
Right, well, and so, like, to be Italian, Italian identity is the traditions of what it means to be Italian, the things that you do on holidays, the foods that you eat. It's Catholic. It's entangled. I knew a guy who went to my Lutheran church for 8 years every Sunday, would not financially give to our church, and would often confess he felt bad about it, but because he was Greek and he had to give to the Greek Orthodox Church, nor would he transfer his membership, because to be Greek meant you were a member of the Greek Orthodox Church. And he knew intellectually this was a contradiction, but he could not bring himself to emotionally do it. He couldn't go into the office and say, I don't want to be a member of the Greek Orthodox Church anymore. Couldn't do it. Because that's to deny his Greekness. And he still had family in Greece. Like, he couldn't do it.
Yeah. It has family implications, so.
Yeah, so, like, I think that sometimes what's behind some of these things as well is a question of real identity, not just spiritual identity, but, like, who I am as a person and the traditions that I hold and the way that I enjoy family. And people can sit back and go, well, your faith shouldn't be based on anything like that. Yeah, I know. In a perfect world, that would be true. But your entire community and the way that you see the world is... I mean, when I left Catholicism, I remember my mother crying and saying to me, I mean, she's fine now. It took her a while. But I remember her saying, we didn't have much money. And we weren't super smart people. And my grandparents had died young. I didn't really know them. And she said, all I could give you that was a lasting heirloom is your faith. And she said it with tears in her eyes. I mean, I almost cried thinking about that conversation. It felt like a betrayal to her. She gave me permission to do it. She supported me, but it was hard for her. And now, you know, I think she is completely fine and thinks it was the right choice in hindsight. That was 20 years ago. She was a younger person as well. I think she's matured in that way. But I'm just saying there is, these things aren't just intellectual. They're caught up in a lot more than just doctrinal points on a list.
I think that would be, you know, just good advice to somebody who's engaging in any conversations with somebody like this too, is patience and love, and that having doctrinal conversations or proclaiming Christ to somebody shouldn't be considered a failure if they don't transfer their church membership, you know.
Yeah, so, I mean, what matters is
that. Sorry, Adam, I just, point. All I could give you was our faith. So she thought I was leaving.
Right.
you know, Protestants were saying, if you're in the Catholic Church, you're not a Christian. But there are Catholics who are saying, if you're a Protestant, you're not Christian. That exists on the other side as well.
Right.
Sorry, Adam.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, labels and adjectives matter in many ways. But when it comes to a person's faith, what matters is who are they trusting and how are they trusting for their salvation, whether they, you know, because you could. Just think for us, like, let's say you move somewhere, Caleb, you move to Greenland or something. I don't know what kind of, well, some, let's just, you move to some island and all there was like, all there was a traditional Catholic church. Mm-hmm. Could you go there in good conscience and participate in the liturgy? You're maybe going to have to when they're ringing the bells, when the elements are allegedly transubstantiated, you know, you got to kind of close your ears or something, right? But could you in good conscience go there and still hear the gospel? I would dare say probably.
Yeah.
Maybe not always, but can you do that even in your own?
Well, on a different, this reminds me of Rod.
But let's say we went to Lutheran Brethren Church. I don't want to throw it in.
Oh, you can pick.
You're going to hear a mismatch in our own tradition, which has a you know, like the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is, if there is a confessional Lutheran church body out there, there's a few other smaller things, but it's the thing, right? And even within the LCMS, you can go from church to church and hear,
oh yeah,
different versions.
I mean, if you just went to all of the churches in one circuit, right?
So that's why I asked the question, you know, what's the question behind the question? Because it's, well, I think the question is important, and certainly historically it's important in terms of like association, it's very important, and all these other things. It's also, it can be quickly a question of identity that is important for the individual. But if you go after that, it can tear families apart. It can ruin somebody's faith. So you got to be very, very careful. And just simply dismissing a denomination you don't like because it has smells, bells, and whistles, or the opposite as non-Christian. I know Bruce is probably, let's see if he twitches. Even the Assemblies of God, though they don't confess the Nicene Creed the way we would probably confess the doctrines of the Nicene Creed, except for maybe baptism for the remission of sins.
Right.
I would maybe even say that the Catholic tradition is more in line with mere Christianity than, say, some of these, the more fringy Protestant traditions that deny baptism.
Yeah. And I would say that, like, writers like Henry Nouwen and Peter Kreeft are probably more Orthodox than C.S. Lewis if you actually assemble some.
To be sure.
Yeah. You know, but Protestants will embrace Lewis like, you know, he's the mouthpiece of Orthodox Christianity, when in fact he's really not. He has some pretty strange, crazy stuff that he believed, including the salvation of Socrates because Socrates just didn't know. So, I mean, it was crazy stuff. But I think an anxiety that undergirds some of this, that maybe is the last thing I would want to say, is there's a sort of soft Gnosticism in the question, because the Gnostics were a heretical sect that went around and basically, I mean, it was a diverse sect, but essentially, if you had to boil it down, you could say you're saved by what you know.
Mm.
And the reason why that's a problem is, you, first of all, you can never have assurance. Second of all, every denomination is wrong about something. They just can't know what it is. But one day they're going to stand before Jesus and he's going to be like, yeah, no, not that one. That point was wrong. We're not saved by what we know, which doesn't mean that what we know is incidental or unimportant, but we're saved by grace through faith in the one that we know. And so that's a much more generous relational way to have salvation than an intellectual way to have salvation, which is what the Gnostics essentially were saying. Your salvation is intellectual. It's getting the right beliefs down. But Orthodox Christianity has actually said it's who you know. And yeah, you have to have a certain correctness about who that is, but that standard is far less stringent than you know, the Gnostics had crazy stuff about eons emerging from different gods and all this other kind of stuff, and you had to believe that in order to be saved. So the question sometimes can lead people to a sort of soft Gnosticism that's show that that's operating in them, like, well, the Catholics might not be Christians because they don't know the right things or they reject the right things. But it's not salvation through bullet points. It's salvation through, like Adam said, trust in Jesus. And that takes a lot of control away from denominations and course of doctrine. And so people don't like that because they will go, well, then you just don't think doctrine's important. No, doctrine's super, super important. But doctrine is an expression of the truth that Paul himself says in the New Testament is incredibly important to teach sound and good doctrine so people aren't led astray. But going back to your, Caleb, your minimum standard, like the line, yeah, we shouldn't stay on the line, but somewhere you have to identify the line. And as Adam said, that line is trust. It's relational. Jesus.
Yeah, I think...
I'm curious...
The question that I've heard come up when anytime you answer this like we have, which is to say, you know, there is this minimum or this line or creedal Christianity, mere Christianity. We can give it a lot of different names, and we have throughout the years on this. You know, genuinely, we have a lot of non-Lutheran listeners to this. I think they're all Christians. At the end of the day, then the question people ask is, why does doctrine matter? And I think it is important to say things like, you know, preserving the faith, withstanding assault on the faith, for the assurance of salvation, for being able to pass that faith down to children or people outside the faith now in a clear and concise manner that delivers saving faith and trust, for communicating and handing over Christ for the forgiveness of sins in a way that people understand and receive clearly, etc. There's a substantially long list that when we say X group is also Christians, we're not throwing our hands up and saying, now the distinct doctrinal realities of Lutheranism don't matter, or in its postmodern sense, only matter for me. I do think they matter for everybody out there who could hear and learn these things. It's just a matter of why.
Yeah, I think that's I know we are coming towards that time. That's a great way to close, lest one think that we're being too loosey-goosey, that doctrines, creeds, and confessions absolutely matter in terms of like locating sort of Christianity, right? And also for the sake of our life of faith, worshiping the living God, your chances, and I don't mean this in like some sort of gambler's way, of going to a Christian church that you can count on to preach the gospel every single Sunday is one that placards its beliefs up front and doesn't make the what's being taught there Sunday and Wednesday and, you know, the 7 days of the week dependent on the mood of the pastor or the prophet or whatever the heck they've got there, but rather on something more that's outside of them, the confession of that particular denomination, if you will. So you mentioned something, Bruce, earlier. This is I'm trying to work our way out of this because it's like almost 50 minutes. But you said you think you're talking about what kind of doctrines are going to be corrected when you get into heaven. I was thinking about, for me, I think it's like I might be off like a year or two on the age of the earth, but I'm curious what it would be for you, Bruce.
Kidding. I'm not going to dox mine, but I have one.
I've sure got lots of things, you know.
I was
Tower 7. What is that? What's up with Tower 7? No.
I was just going to close by paraphrasing a thing from the great historian Yaroslav Pelikan, who wrote a book called Credo, which is on the different development of the creeds. And he points out how the first phrase of the creed, I believe, Credo, starts with relationality and faith, and then it goes into the doctrines about what you actually believe. But that starting point is important because it shows the relationality of our faith. I believe, I trust in. And then it lists the actual doctrines that one trusts in.
Yeah, we should put a plug in for that book that you edited, Caleb, on...
Oh, Credo, yeah.
Credo. Now, from the Here We Still Stand, what, 2-3 years ago now?
I think that one's 3 years ago now. Pelikan famous for being Lutheran, becoming Catholic.
for listeners.
What was it? I thought he went Eastern Orthodox.
Did he go Orthodox? I thought he went Rome.
So I thought he was teaching at what's that seminary in Scarsdale? St. Vlad's? Didn't he teach?
You're probably
there?
Right. Vlad's is Orthodox.
You're thinking of Newhouse, probably.
Oh.
He went Catholic. Which, I mean, boy, I should not say this, but I've always wondered about cats, like these really brilliant guys who were Missouri Synod. It's almost like the Missouri Synod couldn't contain them. They had to leave. their intellects were being...
You were...
Yes, Pelican went to Eastern Orthodox.
Yes, he did. I'm confusing that he was like a scholar in some Roman Catholic areas.
His quote when he did so was, "I was a Lutheran with the greatest knowledge of the Orthodox Church, and now I am an Orthodox with the greatest knowledge of Luther."
What a humble...
Hey, David Anderson of the Faith and Reason Exchange and I, everybody should go and subscribe to that, interviewed Mickey Maddox, who was a Lutheran. I don't know if he was Missouri Synod. I think he was because he taught at River Forest long, long ago. He described himself when we interviewed him as a Lutheran Catholic. And he didn't mean like this evangelical Catholic stuff. He meant he's a Catholic. He attends a Roman Catholic church, but his theology is Lutheran, which I thought was, to use a non-descriptive word, interesting.
Yeah, I've also, we have mutual friends who call themselves Lutheran Anglicans and stuff like that as well. So there's some of that, right, where you know, like Bruce was saying, maybe they're in a particular church for particular reasons, and there's some doctrines that you're carrying over from other places. So, Well, very good, guys. I think that's a fun episode. I hope our listeners enjoyed that, maybe learned something, maybe have some takeaways for dialogues with friends and family and people they know who are Catholic, some patience and love for fellow Christians who are outside of our confession. We hope you enjoyed this, but also if you have been listening to Thinking Fellows for some time, this is one of your weekly podcasts that you enjoy, we would greatly appreciate considering supporting this show and the rest of the 1517 Podcast Network. You know, the Thinking Fellows has maintained a sort of ad-free and uninterrupted conversations for about 7 years now, which is pretty incredible. And we've done that with the help of donors through 1517 and through 1517 Podcasts. If you go to the Support This Show link at the top of the show notes, you can help us keep the Podcast Network free and ad-free. You know, that means there's also a 7-year-plus backlog of Thinking Fellows episodes that are not behind a paywall and things like that. And that's the way I intend to keep things on the Podcast Network as the director of 1517's Podcast Network. And we greatly appreciate everybody who has supported us throughout the years. If you are, if you have questions about supporting this show or any other shows on the Podcast Network, you can use a contact form at 1517 and somebody from our constituent and donor relations department will answer you as quick as they can. And again, thank you to those of you who have supported us throughout the years. We will catch you next time. Bye.
Hey friends, it's Eric Sorensen, co-host of 30 Minutes in the New Testament, here with a special announcement. And that announcement is that 30 Minutes in the New Testament can now be found on YouTube. If you click on the link in the show notes here just below me, you're going to see that we have our own YouTube page. And the reason we're doing that is because from now on, we're going to be recording not just audio of the episodes, which will continue on the various podcast platforms that you use, but we're also going to film our episodes so that you can access video. And so make sure to click on that link, subscribe today so you can keep up with all the clips we release and all our future episodes. Thanks so much.